powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
UW coaching search begins now. Quite honestly, it might have begun before the team even decided to move on from Jimmy Lake officially, because they might have known what was kind of in their future. Now, we'll obviously see who they bring on. We've heard a couple names thrown around. The text line says, what about Kellen Moore, next head coach at UW? Who did Gross say? He joined us at 10:30 and mentioned a name. Do you remember what he said?
Who Gross said?
Yeah.
He had talked about Jim Moorhead.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was his guy that he threw in. And then also said, if you could plead with Chris Peterson to consider returning, he'd also,
I don't know if that's going to happen, but Chris Peterson on the search committee, apparently, to help Jen Cohen with that one. Yogi Roth was on with Mike Salk earlier today, and they talked about kind of the desirability of the UW coaching position and how long the search could take, who potential candidates could be. It was a great interview, but I also thought it was interesting that Yogi had, I think, a more optimistic take than we've heard about the desirability of that job. Now, preface, I'm a UW alum, so I'm not going to, like, trash the school, although I have been very critical. Did you hear that I was a double major from the University of Washington? Yogi talked about
how we've all heard.
Mike asked Yogi, hey, like, how desirable is this job? Like, when you're talking about the big candidates they can land, like, is there a limit to the kind of name they can get? Here's what Yogi said.
Oh, big time. I mean, it's in the category of, can you win big? There's some other jobs like this one and like USC that are open in this league where you can win big. You know, you can go to the playoff. It's been proven in this era by Washington. It's not like you're just leaning on the past of a national championship, you know, many years ago. So I think they've got the resources. They have the facilities that compete with anybody in the country. They've got the fertile recruiting ground in terms of, you know, the Northwest is kicking out players. The West Coast is what you know it is, and is able to recruit nationally.
What I'm hearing is there should be no name that's too big. UW is in a Power 5 conference. It's a program with a great history, even though it's kind of at the mm-hmm. lowest of the lows right now.
Yeah.
And it's not in a great place, but it has been before. And you know, as a head coach going to this program, look, if I want to get to a college football playoff, I can do that with this program.
Yeah, you can. It is one of those programs where if you build it and you do it the right way, it can be sustainable, and it absolutely can rank up there with any of the power brokers that are out there around the country. It legitimately can. And it's also a big reason why Pete Carroll loved the idea of coming to Seattle. It wasn't just the idea. There was a number of factors and, you know, having a bunch of control up here and being the vice president as well as the head coach. And there were a number of factors. But one of the things that Pete Carroll saw was that this was a great sports town, and knew that if he could tap into that fan base and tap into the energy that is here with the 12s and everything that they've been able to create, that you can have something special. And that has been a big part of the fabric of this sports community, is that they will rally around a winner in a big, big way. And you saw it with the Mariners, just giving you a glimpse of what winning baseball can look like in important moments. You know, when they showed up and, you know, over that 3-game stretch there over the weekend, right? They show up. And so UW can absolutely be an intriguing and enticing job and a great job. But with that being said, when Yogi Roth talks about that, that is the reason why UW has to get it right. That's the reason why, yeah, they should spare no expense, but they've got to find the right individual that can carry the torch and that can get them out of this situation that they're currently in and own it and dominate the recruiting trail and get those talented kids that are on the West Coast that are leaving in droves to the Big 12, to the SEC, to the ACC, and keep them on the West Coast.
Yogi also saying, look, if you get the right person for your program, you can absolutely return to being a powerhouse. You can be like that, win like you did under Peterson.
I think it's a big-time job that I think we're all surprised in where it is currently, but I anticipate that it won't take long whenever they make their hire to get this thing going back to the standard, which Chris Peterson brought it back to.
Curtis, you've mentioned the one thing you don't want to see is hiring someone who hasn't been a head coach before.
Yeah, we've been down this road with Jimmy Lake. We've been down this road with Mike Hopkins. You can't risk having a repeat of what we just saw because those are two guys who had never had any head coaching experience before taking over at UW. This is a program that has way too much at stake to get cute with the hire.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that again, you run that risk. Now, Joe Moorhead is an assistant right now. He does have head coaching experience, which I think is intriguing. But if you look at the list of candidates, it is a good sign that most of them are head coaches or previous head coaches at some point along the way.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I also think that if you want to help recruiting, it helps to have someone who's found success at a head coaching position before, who has still connections with certain areas or different recruiters that have worked with him as part of his system, part of his coaching tree. Just because I think you've got to make up a lot of ground there. And I think to do that, you have to have someone that's done it before.
You absolutely have to. And that's you can't take that risk. And still, to me, Joel Moorhead, people like him and like what he's been able to do offensively. And I understand that. And he's had experience. But it still would be a risk, in my opinion, because he wasn't successful at Mississippi State. I mean, he was, eventually he got ran out. And some people would argue that he didn't really get the time that he needed. But still got ran out. And so I look at that situation and I just think you want somebody that is successful, that when they get hired, there is an infusion of energy and excitement about what they can bring and what they can do for the University of Washington, that when recruits hear that name, that either they're intrigued or that it is a hallmark name that you're going, yes, okay, all right, I am absolutely interested to hear this recruiting pitch that I'm about to get from that head coach and his coaching staff. And that to me is something that UW has to go after. James Franklin is somebody that people talked about being pulled to USC from Penn State. That's the only way I would see that happen. I don't see James Franklin going from Penn State to a University of Washington. Would be really surprised to see that. But you could see somebody like, I would say, you talk about pulling guys away from certain individual spots. I mean, Luke Fickell is somebody that, at Cincinnati right now has built a program that is fantastic. He's not even a Power Five program. Would he be interested in coming over to the University of Washington? That to me is somebody that would be incredibly intriguing. The other thing that you want to make sure that you do when you hire somebody along those lines is they have star power or they have West Coast recruiting ties. And that's why a name that I threw out yesterday, somebody like Kalani Sitake from BYU, makes a ton of sense to me. I mean, you look at their offense, what they've been able to do and what they've put together, it's been pretty dynamic. They just had Zach Wilson go into the NFL. They've got a really exciting quarterback right now in Jaren Hall, who's really fun to watch. They have a really strong running game. They're balanced. They play really good defense. And Kalani Sitake, he's an infusion of energy. He'll be the type of guy that's in the student section in men's basketball games, going crazy. And he's got an unbelievable Polynesian connection with his entire coaching staff. He would crush it on the West Coast. But I also don't know if he wants to leave because BYU's been, he's a BYU alum. BYU's his dream job, and they're just moving to the Big 12. But I think that there's a lot of unique names and opportunities for UW, but they have to absolutely get this right.
I think that's the thing, is all I want to see. I don't have a top candidate really in mind. I think what I just want to see is a genuine effort made to get the best person you can possibly think of for your program. I am so tired of hearing about different Seattle teams. They're not this team, some out-of-market team, right? I was talking with Mike Salk earlier about the Mariners spending and how much we think they're going to spend and what if they get outbid? And I said, why the Dodgers and why the Yankees? And he was like, no one spends like those guys, which is true. right? I'm just so tired right now mm-hmm. of constantly looking to other teams outside of the state as, well, you're not that team. Like, I don't think that has to, I understand in a regionally driven sport like MLB, one that where revenue is often determined by a market size as well, even though Seattle's a bigger market than the revenue. I understand. That doesn't have to apply to college. In fact, it doesn't apply. The most successful college program, the most successful college coach is based out of Alabama right now. Like, it does not have to be something that you limit yourself to. You are a major institution in a Power Five conference. There is no reason you shouldn't have the resources and, most importantly, the drive to go after exactly who you want and the best of the best.
Right.
Why not? Why are you going to be like, well, I mean, we're not USC. It's not as desirable. What? You're Washington. Like, I know that you guys are looking at me and you're kind of like making fun of me right now because I'm an alum, but I'm telling you,
yes.
Like, you can sell yourself. You can sell your school. Why would you settle for like, well, let's take some steps.
Well,
let's find an interim head coach. No, turn it around now.
One of the unique points about this, too, that you could sell to anybody out there is you can quickly become top dog at the Pac-12. I mean, look at Mario Cristobal right now. I mean, there's really nobody that's competing with him in Oregon, let's just be honest, in terms of, you know, the competition at the top of the Pac-12 right now. And it would not be hard. I'm talking about any of these Pac-12 schools outside of, I'm sorry, Curtis, Bear Down, Arizona.
Bear Down.
Wow.
Or Colorado.
Right here.
You know, some of those programs, I think it's a little bit harder for them. But a lot of these programs, I believe, you could easily jumpstart a really solid program and compete for the Pac-12 title right out of the gate. And get yourself and solidify yourself as top dog. And so if you're looking at the University of Washington, it may not be USC from the history and the glam and how big of an LA market can be when it's at its best. But the University of Washington can absolutely win and can absolutely turn themselves into a powerhouse on the West Coast and compete nationally, and you can do it relatively quickly. So somebody like Dave Arenada, for example, who, you know, Brock Huber talked about, hey, that would be a guy that I'd be extremely interested in, who's currently the head coach at Baylor. I'm pessimistic about that because I look at LSU, and that's somebody that was a defensive coordinator there that was beloved and well-respected, and I'm sure LSU would be very intrigued to bring him back. But if you're Arenada, do you want to go compete with Nick Saban and everybody else, or do you want to go to the Pac-12 and just have to compete against Mario Cristobal? I mean, that's a very intriguing opportunity.
Right. This hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by Kings Heating and Air. It's time for Four Down Territory.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass. Going inside the game with quarterback guru Jake Heaps.
Jake Heaps played in the NFL, played quarterback, was in the room with him, was in the fire. He's really a guru. He really played the game.
Jake, first down. How has the defense been able to fix themselves again midway through the season?
Well, big part of it comes down to communication, understanding what each guy is going to do, understanding responsibilities. But when it comes to defense, there's so much trust that is involved on that side of the ball. I mean, you got to think about it. It's not, you are told to have a responsibility. This is where your zone is going and where you have to be. You owned this certain area of the field. And if the defender in your area is vacating that to go somewhere else, you have to trust that the guy next to you is going to be in the spot that they're going to be. And if you don't, then maybe you go out of character and you start to attach yourself to guys that are voiding your area of the field, which leads to big plays, right? And you saw that a ton. You saw a lot of guys just not playing their assignments, just simply playing their assignments. And another simple key that they have made to turning that around is, I believe, number one, moving DJ Reed back to his original spot. It has allowed him to be more comfortable, has allowed him to play more aggressively. The style of play, which we saw in the second half of last season, I mean, it's so refreshing to see DJ Reed get back to that. You could just tell he was so uncomfortable on the right side, just completely two different players. And a big reason why you're able to do that is because Trey Brown has come in on the left side and has played extremely well in that position as a rookie. So those two guys, their play has allowed everybody else to play a little bit more confident. permanently. And then the other side of it is Jordan Brooks. Jordan Brooks playing better at the Willside linebacker spot. Bobby Wagner not chasing as much in the middle of the field rather than playing and understanding his zone and understanding and waiting for guys to come into his zone rather than trying to be over-aggressive to things that are in front of him or in passing concepts that are going vertical, and then he just leaves the middle of the field wide open and vacated. So I look at those things as a big reason why they've been able to turn that around, but it just, from a simplistic point of view, it comes down to communication and trust, and right now everybody is on the same page, and it's lent itself to great, great results.
Second down. What's been disappointing so far this season?
To me, it's been, well, the offensive side of the ball as a whole in general has been very disappointing, but I'll point to two areas. Number one, the offensive line has been really disappointing to me so far this season because this is a talented group. And I point to multiple times where we've had Ray Roberts on the huddle, and how many times had he told us throughout the season so far, midway through, that you've got three Pro Bowl level type of talents on your offensive line, yet you have not put it all together. And that has been a big problem. And that has led you, that has made you a group that has been susceptible on pass protection. It's made you a group that has not been as dominant as you were hoping they would be in the running game as well. And so that has been a disappointment to me thus far, because heading into the season, I was very optimistic about the impact that Gabe Jackson would have on this offensive line. And really, Damian Lewis, I was looking for him to take the next step forward, and he has not done that this season. And he's talented. It's not that he's not talented, or I view him and I look at him and I go, gosh, this guy just doesn't have it. It's not that at all, but he just has not been able to put it together, I believe, from, you know, being comfortable, understanding his assignments on every single play, and then just going and executing with technique. And so the offensive line from that perspective has just, they haven't been put in the best position, but they also have not played to the standard I think everybody thought that they would heading into this season.
Right. Third down. 2-minute drill here. Why has the Seahawks offense never been able to find their rhythm this season?
Third down. They are one of the last teams in the league in third down, and that has not allowed them to be in rhythm. So you can complain, like Pete Carroll here in cut number 4. You just hear him being exasperated by the certain situation.
We're real frustrated the way it came out. You know, we had intended to get some stuff going. It didn't work out for us. You know, we just couldn't get a rhythm again. And these guys played really good again on defense, and they gave us a hard time. But we're disappointed, and you know, we go back to every play. You know, we're looking at every play that could have gone the other way, completions or runs, and we're just frustrated. We're not finding the rhythm that we need to find.
So you can point to that. You can be frustrated, but it's not going to change. You're not going to find the rhythm on offense if you're not better on third down. And if you want to avoid third down, then you need to be wildly explosive on first and second down. And in 2020, the first half of the season, that's exactly what they were. They actually avoided a lot of third down situations by just being so good and dominant on first and second down. And that eventually caught up to them as the season went on and they started facing more third down situations. So this is a problem that they've had over the last couple years. And it just comes down to simple execution, doing your job, performing at a high level, and that has been a big reason why this offense has just been so out of whack, has not been rhythmic. You're losing in time of possession. It's because of third down.
Fourth down. Russell Wilson calls himself a fixer, so what does he have to fix moving forward?
The thing that he has to fix moving forward, in my opinion, is just the idea of, it's not even taking what's given to you. It's just getting the ball out of your hands quickly, efficiently, moving on, positive gains, and that is the win. The win is the positive gains, wherever they come from, wherever they're at. And you look at certain situations that happen in the Green Bay game, you point to the second interception of the Tyler Lockett interception, and you know, he had I believe it was Freddie Swain in the flat that he could have thrown to there in that situation, and that is a positive gain. On first down, I believe it was, first or second down, that puts you in a great position. Either you pick up the first down or you're in third and short. So I still believe that you have an attack mentality, you have an aggressive mentality. What you don't want is you don't want him to get the yips, right? You don't want him to be afraid to throw the ball downfield, which he never will be. But it's have that attack mentality, but take what's given to you, get the ball to your hands, and for this offense to facilitate that in the best way possible, to get guys running across the field underneath, giving him easy completions to start the game, getting him out on the edge multiple times throughout the game. I just think once you get him in the flow and you get him firing and getting that look in his eye, he's Russell Wilson, and he plays like one of the best quarterbacks in the league, and that is the thing that they have to, as they're transitioning out of that game and getting into a second game back after being out a month. I think that is going to be an important thing for this offense to be able to do, and that has, in my opinion, what Russell Wilson's got to have that mentality moving forward.
Scott Service is a finalist for AL Manager of the Year. Jake making his case next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacy,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Rost.
All right, I'm looking at the American League Manager of the Year odds from Sports Illustrated. Guess the order they're in, from best odds to longest odds. The three candidates are Rays manager Kevin Cash, Mariners manager Scott Service, Astros manager Dusty Baker for AL Manager of the Year.
I'm going to say most likely Scott Service is last, then Dusty Baker, then Kevin Cash. That's going to be my pessimistic national Major League Baseball point of view.
Well, you are incorrect.
Really?
Yes. The best odds are Kevin Cash, but Scott Service with the second best odds to win the award, and Dusty Baker with the longest odds to
win
the
award. That's what I'm talking about.
Now, this award is going to be announced at 3 p.m. today. If Scott Service wins, he'll be on with Wyman and Bob at 4:45, so keep an eye out for that. Obviously, the great news for him if he wins, but then you guys can follow up and hear him live on our airwaves to hear that first reaction from maybe future AL Manager of the Year, Scott Service. Again, we're about an hour and a half.
He is the AL Manager of the Year.
Well, that's what I want to bring up. So you look at these three guys, and you can certainly make a case for any one of them, right? Dusty Baker is just, I feel like half of Dusty Baker being here is the teams in the World Series, and the other half is people just like Dusty Baker. Like, I feel like that's really what we're dealing with. Kevin Cash dealt with, I think, a similar situation a bit as far as Service, and that you're dealing with a team that isn't going to be a top team in payroll, right? Like, you've got to really, really be fantastic if you're mm-hmm. taking the Dodgers to the World Series. Obviously, they weren't in the World Series, but because you're dealing with the league's highest payroll. When it's the Rays and when it's the Managers, you're in the bottom half of the league pretty solidly. So, yeah, that's pretty impressive. But also, in my mind, the Rays were so much better on paper. And yeah. In practice. And I think Scott Service did the most with the least. Not to slight any of these players, but let's be real. The Rays won the AL East the year prior. They were projected to do it again, and they did. Congrats. It's awesome. I like Kevin Cash, and I like Dusty Baker, but Scott Service did so much more. 90 wins with a team that was projected to have over 90 losses.
Yeah, and he overcame a minus 51 run differential. Right. I mean, like, it's insane when you think about that, to win 90 games. I mean, there's so many people that look at it that just, it is so hard to fathom what they did and to really put it into context. So you talk about the minus run differential. You talk about the fact that before the season even started, you had drama that ensued with the resignation of team president and CEO of Kevin Mather and all the ridiculous
things he said
about players on the team and the way the painted the thought process of the organization on these particular players. Scott Service leading the charge to have to manage those situations, manage those relationships, put out those fires, get those players to, you know, really come together in the clubhouse to believe in what they're doing, believe in what he was trying to sell them, in the midst of a season that was supposed to be deemed as a developmental year, a year where you are losing, where you start to see them improve, but they're still losing, and that's the expectation. Yet he created a winning environment where they truly did Ted Lasso believe, and they turn things around. You look at also Kyle Lewis, your AL Rookie of the Year prior to that, getting hurt and not playing with the team for the majority of the year. You look at the production that you were able to get from you know, unlikely sources, which was your bullpen, and managing that perfectly, nearly perfectly, night in and night out. A starting rotation that fell completely apart that you had to rebuild and restore and put back together.
You lost one of your starters in his first start.
Yes. I mean, it was horrific. And how many players did we get up to that ended up wearing a Mariners uniform? It got up over to 60, didn't it? Was it just around 60?
Yeah, it was like 62, 63.
I mean, are you kidding me? 62 different players wore the Mariner uniform, and you were able to put that team together and win 90 games and have a chance to get into a wild card race? Are you kidding me?
Let's talk
about
that's
an insane job.
Relationships with players. Like, this is not an old school Tony La Russa type of dude. This is a guy when his players in 2020 made it very clear that it mattered to them, not only that they protest during one of those days, but that they be allowed to speak about the Black Lives Matter movement. Service stood right alongside his players and was like, yeah, I support your decision. And you talk about wanting to encourage young leaders. Like, it sounds like we're just stanning Scott Service right now. But when it comes to a conversation genuinely,
because he's earned it,
about a guy who deserves this award, it's hard for me, for whatever you want to critique him about, it is hard for me not to think that he has taken so many steps forward as a manager that was very evident this year,
mm-hmm.
and that one of the things he is greatest at is getting a lot out of young players and being a type of manager that I personally think is kind of refreshing in baseball.
Yeah, it is a unique approach. It's a unique approach in baseball, and I think that it's worked. And it paid dividends when you had legitimate relationship with players, especially when it came to the Kendall Graveman trade. Remember, we all thought that was going to be the killer to the year.
Yeah, we thought they lost the clubhouse.
And they hadn't, right? Scott Service was able to pull those guys together, and the leadership that was created with the young group on that team, and being able to get somebody like Kyle Seager, who honestly was disgruntled, you know, through, you know, the last part of the year, to be bought in and be somebody that was a leader within that clubhouse, to where, you know, maybe he was frustrated with upper management, but he wasn't frustrated with Scott Service. He wasn't frustrated with, you know, the rest of the guys in that clubhouse. You manage relationships. Also, we forget that, you know, you talk about the COVID situation. The Mariners for a long time were one of the few teams that did not have the certain number or percentage of players that were vaccinated. So they had to manage themselves differently as an organization than everyone else for an extended period of time. And that was a unique challenge in and of itself. Like, there's just all these little factors that you put into this that just make it such an unbelievable job. And no, he didn't get to the playoffs like the other two guys did.
Yeah.
But the expectations were significantly lower.
They were in contention in the final weekend of the season.
Correct.
No one saw the Mariners doing that. Literally no one. And if you did, congrats. You're one of I don't know how many people.
Well, especially after they fell down four games with 16 to play.
How about being no hit twice in a span of, 12 days or something like that? Like, I mean, this is a team. You think of that series against the Padres. You thought the season was over then. You think of being no hit for the second time. You think the season's pretty abysmal at that point. You talk about having your phenomenal game against the Astros, one of the most fun Mariners games I can remember watching. And then that series ending on such an ugly note and losing that series to Houston after getting off to such an exciting start. So many moments in this season, you thought they're done.
Yeah.
Or you thought the magic is over. Like, he's going to be unable to corral a group of young guys that haven't been there before into believing after this.
100%. It is that to me has been one of the fun parts about this. And yeah, you could talk about the managing of the bullpen and all those things. That to me is very impressive. You talk about how they were able to manage and the work that Mitch Haniger put in himself to have an unbelievable year. But Scott Service staying true to his plan and wanting to make sure that they kept Mitch Haniger healthy. But the thing that impresses me the most, and the thing that was his biggest challenge, was to create a winning culture amongst a rebuilding process, amongst so much losing.
And guys that hadn't won before.
Right, and that is exactly what he did, to the point where they took off starting in June. They took off and were one of the best teams behind, I can't forget the other two teams, but they were third in terms of best record against teams above 500. Third best in the AL. I mean, that's absurd. And
the Rays might have been one of them.
I just think that when you're talking about the job that he did in the unlikely circumstances and with the group that he had, Scott Service to me is by and far away the AL Manager of the Year, and I will be extremely disgusted if he's not.
Are you going to be more mad?
Does it make sense?
What will make you more mad? Scott Service not winning AL Manager of the Year, or Troy Aikman talking about Matthew Stafford? Troy Aikman.
Just football in general? I mean, yeah. Man, that's a real tough one. Troy's himself. He's going to be who he is, whereas I believe, you know, in the circumstance where Scott Service, amongst all the doubt and amongst all of the, you know, conversation around him and what kind of manager he is, he 100% deserves this award, and I would be really, really disappointed to not see him get it when I feel like he earned it. It's not a campaign. It's not a feel-good story. This is something that he legitimately has earned with the job that he's done this season.
All right. Again, that award is being announced at 3 p.m. today, Pacific time. So if you're here listening to 710 ESPN Seattle, Wyman and Bob will be tracking all of it. They'll announce it the minute that award is announced. So you'll find out on our airwaves, obviously, whether or not Service is getting the award. And then if Service does win, he'll join Wyman and Bob at 4:45. So let's hope that happens. I very much look forward to that interview.
If he doesn't, baseball writers everywhere should be ashamed of themselves.
If he doesn't, I'm getting mad online.
That's right.
Woo! There you go.
Taking it to Twitter.
All right. We are wrapping things up with What I Need to Know. Send in any question you have, any question, to 206-421-3776. That's the Mac and Jack's text line. Your questions coming up next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Ross.
It's What I Need to Know, brought to you by All Red Heating, Cooling, Electric. Let's start with this question from the 206, non-sports related. What's your go-to fast food item in this state? Is this someone from out of state?
Yeah.
Also,
most
fast food places that I like are kind of everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, if you were on Mars, you could find a Taco Bell, I think.
Correct. There's not anything locally that I would say, oh, you got to go here, that's so different from everyone else. And I don't know if that's a sad thing, but I don't really care because it's still great food. But I don't. Is he just asking for fast food in general or something local fast food?
Maybe just a fast food item. Presumably it would be local since it's a place you guys have had to go to all the time where you're like, yeah, I'll buy
Dick's Deluxe or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, Dick's,
it's like local
Dick's would,
fast food.
Yeah, Dick's would absolutely be up in that category. Although I have to go with a place, Curtis, that I love more than anything. It's not fast food, but it is kind of fast. It's like Chipotle, but it's Cafe Rio.
The 360 fast casual.
Cafe Rio's unbelievable.
Says Salk ranked fast food items this morning.
Ah, fast food items.
You know someone I would bet money has not had that many fast food items? Michael Salk. Like, I am willing to bet a lot of money that he has not tried more than a quarter of the menu.
I think that's very fair.
Any random fast food chain. I'm sure of it.
Well, yeah, because he's looking for some, like, bougie meal somewhere.
He shamed Jake and I for saying jalapeno poppers were like one of the greatest hors d'oeuvres. He was like, yeah, that's not an hors d'oeuvre.
Yeah,
dude,
he started rattling off.
Yeah,
these...
they're amazing. What do you mean?
I think Stacy's bougie, and
I am.
And Salk made Stacy look like nothing. I mean,
right?
It was,
which is
honestly, it was
something.
Shocking. I mean, fries have to be number one. How are fries not number one at a fast food restaurant?
I'm not sure.
You don't think so?
A great meal can be ruined with bad fries.
It's true, but also, I don't know. I mean, like, I think fries kind of make or break it.
Like, fast food fries, probably the worst ones, I would say, are like Burger King or Dairy Queen. Those are the worst fries.
No, I agree.
All right. Next question here from the 509. What I need to know, do you see DK signing a long-term contract if offered? I think it depends on the quarterback situation.
Yeah.
If Russell Wilson's here and or if you have a franchise guy, then yeah, if I'm a premier wide receiver and I'm offered a deal, I am not signing if there isn't someone that I think can get me the ball consistently.
Right.
Why would you? I wouldn't blame someone for that.
Yeah, I fully agree with that assessment. I there's nothing that I would add to that other than to say as well is, okay, there are run-first heavy offenses that do feature very dynamic and explosive playmakers. So if you feel like you're still going to be targeted, you're still going to get your catches, you're still going to get your yards, even in a system that is, you know, heavy run-oriented, you know, look at, for example, the Tennessee Titans and A.J. Brown, right? A.J. Brown, who's one of his closest friends, if not his closest friend, has had a very successful run with Tennessee, and they have obviously been in a very run-heavy oriented offense. So I don't necessarily believe it has to do with the offense, but you're right. I believe it has to do with the quarterback.
Now, let me remind you guys that it's also time to announce the Seahawks code word. Head to 710sports.com/win. W-I-N, and enter the code word DEFENSE, D-E-F-E-N-S-E, by the end of our show to be entered to win two tickets to see the Seahawks host the Cardinals on Sunday. Remember, this code word expires at the end of our show, and you'll have another chance to win during Wyman and Bob. Details and rules at 710sports.com/win. Again, that's where you're going to enter that code word, DEFENSE. What I need to know, what are your thoughts on the Kraken this season? Will they turn things around after the break or soon? I'll answer quickly, which is I don't think they'll drastically turn things around. I think this is just a different team than we thought it would be. I don't know how much they can improve defensively or with goaltending. I think the bar is higher than where they're at right now, but I think what we're realizing is this team is not as good as Vegas, and that's okay, but our expectations were very heavily skewed.
Yeah, I'm going to go out on a limb and say I don't even believe the Kraken are going to make the playoffs. So
that's fair.
Unless they go on the run of a lifetime here, I really don't believe that they're going to make the playoffs with everything that's going on. They don't really have anything tangible that you could say, this is the identity of the team. This is who they are. And that was something that is really shocking at this point, because you thought for sure with their lineup that they would be a heavy defensive-minded team, and that is far from the truth right now. So I just think this is a tough year, first year, and we'll see what Ron Francis and Dave Haxtell are able to get these guys to do by the end of the year and ultimately find a way to improve their team in the offseason. But obviously, there's still a ton of intrigue. There's still a ton of excitement around the team and finding who are going to be the guys that are going to legitimately stick around with this club and who's going to help keep them improving as the years go on.
Need to know, when you eat candy that comes in mixed colors like M&Ms, do you eat them systematically or just grab and eat with no regard? To which I would say, if you are sorting M&Ms into colors before you eat them, I think you're a serial killer.
Now, if it's Skittles,
no,
that's more reasonable because
they're different.
You're
flavors.
Mixing flavors.
The only thing with the M&Ms are the candy coated shells. There's no flavor difference. If
correct.
You are, if you in your hand, if I'm with someone and I see them put M&Ms in their hand, sort them into colors in their palm, and then eat them one by one in the colors, I'm getting away from that person as quick as I possibly can.
I believe that's I believe that's very fair. And when it comes to Skittles, I still think it's the same thing. Because, yeah, there's a little bit difference in the flavor, but how much of a difference? It's not like it's jelly beans. It doesn't have that much difference in variety in the flavor.
The grape ones, they stand out in terms of flavor.
Oh, they do?
Same with the lemon
ones.
Even
then, when you mix all the flavors of Skittles, it doesn't taste bad.
No.
It just tastes sugary.
Tastes like a bunch of artificial flavoring.
Which is fantastic. I love me some Skittles.
Yeah, no offense to this texter. They said, sorry, I have a little OCD.
Sounds like it.
It's totally fine.
It's okay.
Totally fine. But
as long as you acknowledge it and understand it's a little weird.
You are
then
who you are.
You just get ripped
fine.
To shreds texting in here. Sorry.
All right, that'll do it for us today. Again, as a reminder, AL Manager of the Year announcement coming up at 3 p.m. If Scott Service wins, he will be on with Wyman and Bob at 4:45. For Jake Heaps, for Curtis Rogers, I'm Stacey Ross. Wyman and Bob coming your way next on 710 ESPN Seattle.